WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Japanese apocalyptic cult group Om Shinrikyo just made its first public apology for its nerve gas attacks in the Tokyo subways. In 1995, the cult group released sarin, a lethal nerve gas, on 5 Tokyo trains during early morning rush hour. 12 people were killed, over 5,000 were injured. The cult's leader, Shoko Asahara, is currently on trial for masterminding at least 17 crimes, including the sarin attack. The Japanese parliament is expected to pass a new law that would allow the government to monitor Om Shinrikyo and other murderous cults. My guest, Robert J. Lifton, is the author of a new book about Om Shinrikyo, Apocalyptic Violence and the New Global Terrorism, called Destroying the World to Save It. Lifton is the author of previous books about Nazi doctors and the psychological impact of living in a world with nuclear weapons. He says the sarin subway attack was part of Om Shinrikyo's larger plan.
The sarin attack that we know about on March 20th, 1995, was a kind of diversionary measure. They were trying to fool the police into thinking it was someone else because they knew the police were closing in. Their longer-standing plans were to create a much larger sarin release, which would confuse everyone and bring America in and Japan and be the way of triggering World War III, which would in turn bring about Armageddon.
What was the extent of Om Shinrikyo's weapons?
Well, they stockpiled bacteriological, biological weapons and chemical weapons, which they called not only poor man's nuclear weapons, as many do, but energy-saving nuclear weapons. Deep down, their love was for nuclear weapons. And that's why I speak of Asahara's nuclearism. In nuclearism, he resembles lots of other people throughout the world who have embraced nuclear weapons, first out of their fear of them and then trying to take hold of their ultimate power and depended upon them, almost deified them. Asahara had that kind of nuclearism and sought nuclear weapons actively, but fortunately was not able to obtain them.
Now, why did Asahara want to destroy the world, to bring on Armageddon?
Asahara felt that the world was hopelessly defiled. And in this sense, you need a vision of your own virtue in order to kill large numbers of people, in this case, in order to destroy the world. And all this, of course, was tied in with a Christian idea of Armageddon from the book of Revelation. So it's a complex but fiercely held idea that in the destruction of the world comes spiritual renewal.
We have an interesting brew of religions and prophecies that go up to create his vision. You mentioned the book of Revelations. I think you say in your book that he's also really interested in the prophecies of Nostradamus. There's some Hinduism and Buddhism combined in here. Can you talk a little bit about the things that he's kind of mixed and matched to create his philosophy?
It's wildly eclectic, and for many disciples that made it all the more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Asahara, he considered it a Buddhist group or Buddhist cult, but his god was Shiva, or sometimes called Shiva, which he's a Hindu god, but Asahara was attracted to Shiva because Shiva is the god of yoga, and Asahara was an expert yoga teacher, and Shiva is also famous for dancing the cosmos to its destruction and recreation, an ideal figure for Asahara. But he also embraced Hindu and Buddhist endings, Kali Yuga and Mappo. These endings are not dramatic like Armageddon. They are gradual deterioration, the expression of gradual deterioration over centuries, but a kind of end of genuine spirituality. Armageddon, though, was his central world-ending focus, especially during the last year or two of the cult's viability. And really, Armageddon is embraced by groups all through the world, partly because it is so absolute and dramatic. And I should add that Nostradamus, who was so important in all this, he was a 16th century French mystic, But there were hundreds of editions of translations of Nostradamus selling millions of copies in Japan. The Japanese might have been the greatest consumers of Nostradamus anywhere. And of course, he was the central figure because of his prediction of the end of the world at the time of the year 2000. All of these went into Asahara's world-ending project.
Who was Shoko Asahara before he became the leader of Aum Shinrikyo?
Well, you know, I say in my book that his only real talent was being a guru. And I find that it's almost impossible to explain the emergence of a guru through any psychological interpretation of his childhood or her childhood. But in his case, he went to a school for the blind from the age of 6 to 20 in Kyushu, southern Japan. He was from a rural area, child of a very impoverished tatami maker, and he was sent to that school. He was sent to a school for the blind, even though he had partial vision in one eye, none in the other eye, because an older brother was completely blind, and it was economically convenient for the family for him to go there. But he always deeply resented this. He was manipulative, in a sense, lording it over the other kids because he did have some sight. And he was said to be somewhat violent at that time and a little bit paranoid in that he blamed his teachers for bad-mouthing him and not permitting him to become class leader, whereas they told him the other students were afraid of him. He was also very ambitious, talked about becoming Prime Minister of Japan, and he loved performance, plays and the like. All of these characteristics entered into his later guruism, but they don't really explain the later guruism, and I don't think anybody's childhood completely explains his or her adult self, because the self is an ongoing kind of process or entity that builds its own structures. In any case, he had brushes with the law, and he really made his own mythology of a couple of intense religious visions around which he said he formed Aum Shinrikyo. And the question arises, and you have to raise this question when you talk about gurus, of what this charisma entailed. Because everybody talks about charisma, but it isn't always very precise as to what we mean about it. And I think the charisma that a man like Asahara had was the capacity to invoke in people an intense life power, a sense of great vitality and meaning in their lives, and also a sense of immortality, of being part of a marvelous, unending spiritual entity. And those are very powerful lures that people have, and I think that was the kind of charisma he had. One would have never predicted this if one simply knew his past history.
My guest is Robert J. Lifton, and his new book is called Destroying the World to Save It, Aum Shinrikyo, Apocalyptic Violence and the New Global Terrorism. Robert Lifton, you've spent a lot of your professional life writing about the psychological impact of living in a world with nuclear weapons. And you've written about the survivors of Hiroshima. You've written about what it's like to have lived during the Cold War with the possible imminence of nuclear war. Now, Aum Shinrikyo is a Japanese cult group that sounds like it was very influenced by the bombing of Hiroshima. And could you talk a little bit about the personal impact that the nuclear bombing of Hiroshima had on the leader of Aum Shinrikyo?
Yes, Hiroshima had an enormous impact on Shoko Asahara. He often predicted that there would be many Hiroshimas, that Japan would be devastated by many Hiroshimas. And that pattern I call nuclearism, that is, first terrified of the weapons and then embracing them, as I said before. But he did it as a citizen, even if very alienated, of the country, the only country that has been atom-bombed. He then extended that idea to a kind of vision that Hiroshima was the symbol and the place, the locale, for World War III. So he described a vision in which he made an astral journey to an unknown place, and he noticed that people had terrible scars and looked decimated, and he asked them what this was, and they said it was Hiroshima. And then he said, has World War III occurred? And the answer was yes. So he was obsessed with Hiroshima, with nuclear war, with radiation, and that was behind, really, much of his energy toward destroying the world. It's a kind of sequence of nuclearism. And in my more recent thinking, even after writing this book, I think of a kind of trickle-down nuclearism, starting with the major countries like the United States and the Soviet Union, the major nuclear powers, and then extending to medium-sized countries who can make them or have them, as Saddam Hussein has tried to do, and now trickling down to non-governmental cults who can at least imagine acquiring these weapons. And I see that the very existence of nuclear weapons in the world has an additional danger, because I can see from this study that they become a lure, an attraction for a megalomaniac guru, because such a megalomaniac guru can readily feel, I alone am capable of destroying the world if I can acquire these weapons, perhaps all by myself or with a few disciples. And that means that the weapons enter into this psychological dynamic in a very active way.
Shoko Asahara, the founder of Aum Shinrikyo, sounds, you know, like a megalomaniac, you know, like someone who wants to control the whole world, in fact, kill everybody in the world so that the world could be reborn more pure. I mean, yet he must have had a lot of charisma or something, because he attracted a following. What is it about his personality or about his recruiting techniques that engaged people into following him?
Yes, that's a very important question, and nobody can answer it precisely, but my sense is that a guru like Asahara has a certain kind of brilliance, maybe superficial brilliance, and that includes antennae for what conflicts people are experiencing, especially young people in Japan, and the deep conflicts, often apocalyptic conflicts, that are reflected in popular culture, which Asahara was very connected to. He was constantly interacting with popular culture, understood it, embraced it. And that's a skill that a guru like this has, as well as a capacity to envision something beyond these conflicts. In his case, to sense that people wanted and needed, or many did anyhow, spiritual certainties, that they were feeling that they were missing some kind of spiritual or religious component in their lives. This could have been particularly true for scientists and people involved in technology. So this is a certain sensitivity and skill that can take him into a form of charisma, which then becomes a holding forth to potential disciples of a new life, which is vital and has meaning, and a new sense of immortality, being part of something much larger than oneself that spiritually endures forever.
If you're just joining us, my guest is psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton. His new book is called Destroying the World to Save It, Aum Shinrikyo, Apocalyptic Violence and the New Global Terrorism. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert J. Lifton, author of a new book about Aum Shinrikyo called Destroying the World to Save It. Now, you write that you had to do a juggling act to both retain a sense of Aum's evil, while you sympathized with many of the intelligent young people whose spiritual quests had rendered them vulnerable to this guru. What were some of the reasons why, you know, smart young people became members of Aum? What did they see in Aum?
It's a very controlled society in relation to family and its institutions, and a growing number of young people are alienated and upset and feel themselves separate from all this and wanting to stay separate from all this. And the young people I interviewed were of this type. So they were alienated. They were religious or spiritual seekers. They were seeking some dependency on a leader, seeking a leader or a messiah. All of this went into their vulnerability to Aum. And I must add that in most cases, they didn't know about the stockpiling of biological and chemical weapons or the efforts to acquire nuclear weapons. What they did encounter in Aum were little evidences of violence at an individual level, which they preferred to fend off, to numb themselves to, and not to take in. So they were deeply confused when they came out. They understood Asahara and Ohm's criminality and were shocked by it, and at the same time had difficulty extricating themselves psychologically from Asahara's influence because they had so thrived psychologically in what they considered to be mystical experiences while they had been in Ohm. And they longed for those old energies. And some of these mystical experiences had been created by very rapid breathing, which induces deoxygenation and makes one very vulnerable for high states and what they called mystical experiences. But they can be deeply satisfying, and people can become addicted to them, as did these young people. So you can really see how much held them to Ohm and how difficult it was for them to extricate themselves from all this.
The people of Om Shimrikyo saw themselves not as a cult, but as a religion. And initially they had religious status under Japanese law. In writing about cults over the years, have you been able to draw the line in your mind that divides religion from cult group?
Well, that's an active question, and there's a lot of acrimony about it. Should we call these groups new religions, which is a relatively neutral term, or should we call them cults, which is pejorative? And my way of speaking to this question is to say, I want to call a group like Ohm a cult because that says something rather than retreating into the term new religion. But if I'm to do that, I have to tell my criteria for assuming them to be a cult. And the criteria I use are threefold. One is that they are totalistic, absolute in their practice, and they have a thought reform-like manipulation of a kind I've described in various work. Second, that there is a shift from large religious principles toward worshiping the person of the guru. And then third, a typical combination of genuine search or religious or spiritual quest from below and exploitation, economic and sexual, from above. So with those three characteristics, I think we can call them a cult. And then the other implication of your question is that what becomes confusing is that the religious and the political and the military or militarized all join and merge. And that was certainly true about Ohm. So you can have what starts out as a religious cult, and it was and I guess still is a religion and a religious cult, which takes on heavy political and militarized attributes, or you can start out as a military or a paramilitary group, as are many of the right-wing cultic movements, which take on a very spiritual quality. I mean, they have certain religions like Christian identity, and they combine also, they also embrace the Book of Revelation in many cases, as did Ohm. So they mix the political with the religious, with a blending and confusion of all these things. And even the greatest destroyer of all, the Nazi movement, which was primarily political as we see it, was in many ways cultic and religious, even in its imagery of the Thousand-Year Reich. And people now, many people look upon it as millennial and something of a vast millennial cult. So we have to be on the lookout for the blending of all these components.
What's one or two of the new things that you learned either about cult groups or cult leaders from studying the Japanese cult Om Shinrikyo?
Well, I really learned in a new way. As long as I've been preoccupied, some might say obsessed, with nuclear weapons, I learned something new about the lure of these weapons for the megalomaniac personality. And that's really dangerous because Asahara is not the only megalomaniac person around. The danger of the weapons just as they exist. And I also learned how ordinary everyday people, like some of these young people I interviewed, can be drawn into murderous projects, which are not seen as such at the beginning as they're drawn into them. Now, in a way, I had learned a similar lesson in studying Nazi doctors. None of them whom I interviewed or learned about had killed anybody prior to Auschwitz or their involvement in the so-called euthanasia program. So an ordinary person can be drawn into a murderous movement or project and can be socialized to it or drawn into its by its appeal, and then can join in murderous behavior. And that I learned in a new way from Om Shinrikyo. And then finally, I would say I had a really strong sense in doing this study that, you know, here is Japan. I've looked at some groups in the United States. I've learned about European and Canadian cults and a little bit about cults on the Indian subcontinent. There is a kind of common mindset of apocalyptic violence and cultic behavior that is worldwide. And this kind of event, dangerous as it is, can occur anywhere, and we have to recognize that. That's why I say, incidentally, that this book is not a cry of pain or despair. It's an insistence on awareness, and in that way, an expression of hope.
Well, Robert J. Lifton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks very much for having me on your program.
Robert J. Lifton's new book is called Destroying the World to Save It, Om Shinrikyo, Apocalyptic Violence, and the New Global Terrorism. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.